Oh, yeah. 108 here on WWLAMFM.com and always live on the free Odyssey app. It is a rainy Thursday afternoon here in Crescent City. Looking out through my window, it's a whole lot of moisture coming down from the sky, quite overcast. I've been listening to Peyton Malone all week. He says it's going to be this way on and off. I hope that doesn't mess up your plans for all the awesome festivals there are this weekend. We got Fried Chicken Festival. We got the Gretna Fest. We got Blues, Brews, and Barbecue out in the parish. We got so much to talk about today, from weather to politics to Pizza Hut. First, reach over and turn it up. This is what you've been working for. All right. Like I said a moment ago, a big anniversary this year. If you were in elementary or middle school anywhere between 1984 and today, you may have encountered Pizza Hut's Book It program, which is turning 40 years old this year, and the pizza chain is giving out free pizza all month. It got me wondering, what books do you remember reading as a kid that left an impression on you? Do you still remember to this day? And, you know, it can maybe be something, not super sophisticated, like, I don't know, The Stinky Cheese Man and other fairly odd tales, or, you know, I don't know, maybe it's something a little more sophisticated, like Lord of the Flies or The Scarlet Letter. I don't know. I want to hear from you about what books you remember reading as a kid, whether it was part of the Pizza Hut program or not. What books do you remember reading as a kid that left an impression on you? And what book or books would you give to a kid today? Either just because you wanted them to have a good time, or you wanted them to, you know, expand their horizons a little bit with, something besides, you know, like The Hungry Caterpillar. We'll talk about that all afternoon. If you want to just shoot me a text about a book that left an impression on you, we can kind of reminisce about that. I don't remember real clearly what books I read from the Pizza Hut Book It program, but I damn sure remember getting those pizzas. Because let me tell you, when you're, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is, you know, white hot at the time. Getting a personal pan pizza in exchange for reading a 40-page book felt like winning the lottery. You felt like a god on those days when you got a pizza. I can practically taste it now. Lots to catch up on today locally. Like you heard me tell Newell, Mayor LaToya Cantrell on Wednesday gave this kind of like pretty contentious appearance at the city council meeting. Supposed to be a budget meeting where, they're looking forward and they're talking about the future. And she kind of pulled a Trump card and made it all about the past and attacked them for, what she perceives as unfair criticism and attacks on her. But she did say that she had a track record of delivering results. Let's take her at her word. What are those results? In what areas are we better off now than we were at the beginning of Mayor LaToya Cantrell's tenure? So we're going to take a spin around the city and look at what's gotten better and what's gotten worse. And we're going to cover everything. We got, crime, infrastructure, housing, and more. And we'll ask, too, what more could Cantrell be doing in the next 465 days before the next mayor is sworn in? And yes, I counted. The next mayor will be sworn in on January 12th in the year of our Lord 2026. That is 465 days from today. For some people, that seems like an appropriate amount of time. For others, that day can't come soon enough. We're going to be talking to Rosalind Cook, who's an adjunct professor of political science at Tulane University, about all that. That's coming up at 325. In just a few minutes here, we're going to be speaking to Tony Marino. Tony Marino is the chair of an outfit called the New Orleans Nine, and he's the first vice president of the Louisiana Landmark Society. And they have a new report out. They do this every year. The Louisiana Landmark Society has published this list of New Orleans Nine most endangered sites. And some of these are actual physical locations. Some of them are a little bit more like institutions or ideas that are endangered, but it's all still really important stuff. So we're going to go through that list and ask, whether it's neglect or, malice or just some sort of other unwelcome development. Who's going to save our parks, our churches, our neighborhoods from certain doom? In a few minutes, we'll be talking to Tony Marino from the Louisiana Landmark Society about that. I have an enormous pile of other headlines, you know, some fun stuff, some sort of more serious stuff, some really odd stuff happening in politics that we'll get to mostly, you know, after this conversation with Tony. And again, in the 2 o'clock hour, we'll do a news bomb and kind of high dive on some of what's happening on the campaign trail in the recovery efforts for Hurricane Helene in the Middle East and much more. I did want to say hello to Coleman. Hi. How are you?
Hey, Ian, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I got an idea for a party.
You have? I'm always down for some sort of a party.
Because, you know, I like to throw parties. I like to throw house parties.
See, with the recent news of Diddy...
It's not that kind of party, Coleman.
Okay, I keep an open
mind. I don't have that much money. I'm not out here buying 1,000 gallons of baby oil.
Okay, I'll keep an open mind. Hit me with it.
I got an idea for a shred party.
A shred party?
A shred party. Now, stay with me here.
All right, we're locked in.
It's a party where you shred stuff. I'm going to go out and get a shredder that you would use to, like, shred up important documents or whatever. And I'm going to put the shredder, like, in the middle of my living room, and I'm going to tell people, hey, come on over to my house, and we're just going to shred stuff all night.
See, this would have worked before the advent of social media, how we use emails and stuff. Like, do you have any papers that you have to shred personally, or is it more like...
No, it can be. I mean, if you got, like, old bills or love letters, you know, from your ex or whatever that you want to come over and, like, shred symbolically, you can do that. But if you also just want to shred up, like, old newspapers, it's about... I mean, shredding stuff is kind of objectively fun, I think.
Yeah,
people enjoy shredding things.
I would love to come, but I would have to make up stuff to shred because, you know, most of the work I do is all digital. You know, it's on computer or laptop. You see my little tablet where I draw my little, like, I rarely use anything, like, physical. I rarely use physical paper for anything other than, you know, this show or whatever.
Yeah,
other than that,
there's a lot of paper around.
I would have to, like, actually make stuff just so I can shred and pretend like I'm involved.
Well, at the party, I'm going to have, you know, a pile of paper, like you could BYOP.
Okay.
You know, you can bring your own paper to shred. Or if you didn't show up with any of your own shreddable stuff, you can shred some of the stuff that I brought home.
All right.
Maybe I bring it home from work, or, you know, it could be like old newspapers and stuff.
Now, after we shred the stuff, like afterwards, and everybody's highly intoxicated, are we going to play a game where we try to, like, tape it back up together, like the Penguin did in Batman Returns? Remember how he had
I forgot about that. All right, he did that in the Better Call Saul, too, I think.
Yeah,
like had like two episodes where he's taping
something
back together.
I think trying to put the shredded stuff back together would be more fun than shredded, but we'll see what happens.
Well, you know, to each his own, Coleman. It's going to be a big party. And, you know, like, and I even thought, you know, you could have, like, food that matches the theme. You could have, like, shredded chicken or, like, pulled pork.
Can I dress up like the Shredder from Ninja Turtles?
Absolutely dress up like the Shredder from Ninja Turtles. I want people to come up and, like, whatever, you know, whatever it means to you. You know, if it's like you dress up like the Shredder, or you're like, oh, like Eddie Van Halen, who's like doing shredding guitar solos.
Or get your abs right and get your, like, a
just
shredded 8-pack.
Shredded, absolutely. Yeah, whatever it means to you, man. The important thing is that you come over, you know, have a couple cold drinks, you eat some shredded chicken, you shred some stuff, and then we're done by midnight, right?
I'm down.
Okay, man, I'll call you. I'll call you when we get around to doing that. If at any time you want to react to anything you hear on the show today, or you want an invitation to my shred party, the way to get in touch is the Okunart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. That number is, of course, 504-260-1870. 504-260-1870. You can also send me a text there. I'm going to read 100% of the texts that you send me today. I'll reply to as many as I can. And the very best ones, I'm going to read on the air. So make them count. Scoot will be back soon, but for the next 2 hours and, you know, 43 minutes, it's just you and me and the wallpaper. So get in touch. 504-260-1870. I'm Ian Hoke, sitting in for Scoot, and I'll be right back after this. Stick around. Get ready for Monday Night Football when the Saints take on Kansas City. Coverage starts Monday at 3 o'clock. They're going to be live from Rouse's Market on Barone in the CBD. First up, First Take with Steve Geller and Charlie Long. Followed at 5 o'clock by Bobby Hebert with the Bud Light Bite Countdown to Kickoff. Game time with Deuce and Haas, 7:15. Turn down that TV and turn up the home team. And when it's all over, you're going to sound off on the Ciroc Point after with the Cajun Cannon until 1 a.m. Saints Chiefs, 10 hours of wall-to-wall football Monday on WWL in the free Odyssey app. I cannot wait. I think this is my only chance to see the Saints in primetime this year just because some happy accidents with my calendar, so I'm pretty fired up. I hope you are too. Go Saints. Joining me on the line right now is Tony Marino. Tony is the chair of the New Orleans Nine and first vice president of the Louisiana Landmark Society. Tony, thanks so much for making time today. Nice to speak with you.
Hey, Ian, Aaron.
Ian, there you
go. Good job to you as well.
Yeah, nice to meet you, bud. You got it. Okay, so for folks who don't know anything about the Louisiana Landmark Society or the New Orleans Nine, just kind of give us a brief overview of what y'all do over there. What's your mission?
Yeah, the Louisiana Landmark Society started this New Orleans Nine back in 2005, and it models what is done by the National Historic Trust that has done. They actually identify sites around the country called 11, and we thought we'd model that for the New Orleans metropolitan area as well, and we have done this, and I've been the chair of this committee for the last 3 years, and as you mentioned, I'm the first vice president of Louisiana Landmark Society. And the purpose is really to highlight, generally it's been highlighting sites, but we've expanded to cover issues and policies in the city of New Orleans that have effect on either neighborhoods or citywide.
Okay, excellent. Well, tell us about the 2024 list. What criteria do you use to determine what makes it onto the list?
There is a 9-point criteria that we look at, and I should mention that the committee is made up of, this year we had 13 members, and we had 23 nominations that come from various organizations, individuals, and other groups that have expressed concern about either policy issues or not. And we look at whether highlighting any of these particular issues or sites will have the effect of getting the site restored or put back into commerce, or whether the issue can be expanded to address community concerns. So we've highlighted 9 of the 23, and it took a process, but it makes up of various organizational groups and representatives around the city. And we don't limit it to one particular area of town. It's generally a citywide approach when we do these things. First off, we nominated New Orleans Tree Canopy. It's a citywide issue affecting the tree canopy in New Orleans, given the fact that we're having issues with removal of many trees, both from a architectural feature of and cultural feature of the city. We also have the Big Green Easy Plan. What we're trying to do is to develop a master plan for the Big Green Easy to encourage more parks and green spaces for the city. We also identified the River District Development Area, which has a project called Topgolf, and that has upset many of the people in the Lower Garden District, given the sense, the size and sense of the operations there.
Yeah, we're going to get to the rest of the list for sure, but I'd like to just kind of examine these a little more detail as we go.
Yeah, we can go in detail as you want. I don't know if you wanted to highlight all 9.
We are going to get to all 9. That's my promise. So let's start with the tree canopy. You know, whether it's environmental causes like it's termites or the trees are old or the wind blows too hard in the wrong direction or we filled them up with concrete back in the 90s because we thought that was a good way to save the trees. Strange. So, I mean, how bad is this problem? What can we do about it? I think people have a perception that New Orleans, you know, is this very leafy city, and it's not. I think I read that the canopy coverage is only like something 18%, which is actually quite low.
Yeah, it actually is the percentage reduction over the years. This goes back to Katrina to 2005, and there has been studies that show the reduction. Actually, there is a loss of almost 40% since 2005, and some of it's due to storm damages and influence, but a lot of it has been the neglect by public work projects, including utility projects, that putting in necessary utility features that we may need. But it's also causing the removal of many iconic oak trees and other types of trees in the city.
Wow.
And the goal is to try to implement a reforestation plan to update the city code to allow to prevent further damage for these trees. And also, it has an effect on flooding and also the visual character of the city, as
absolutely,
well as perhaps some climate influence.
Mm-hmm. Just to go back and highlight something you said there, you said we've lost 40% of the tree canopy since 2005, correct?
Yeah.
That's
right.
Nuts. That's almost half just in 20 years.
And they've looked at other cities that have that, and we're falling way below the amount of tree canopies in the nation.
Oh, I hate that. Wow. Okay, so what's the kind of first rung on the way to solution? What's the kind of low-hanging fruit here, Tony?
Well, first off is to prevent further removal of trees and mandate a policy to the city agencies and also utility providers that they'll actually implement safeguards when they are doing the necessary work for the infrastructure, that they also are mindful that the trees are important. They don't just remove the trees or damage them in the process of doing their work.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, let's move on to the second one here, the Big Green Easy Plan. It's a potential solution for revitalizing our parks and our green spaces. Tell us about what are the big obstacles in terms of the plan to revitalize parks and green spaces, and what do we do to gain some traction here?
Well, the goal is to have smaller green spaces, no more recreational areas, which have been neglected for the long term. There was, you know, a plan back in the 1956 that really needs to be updated to increase the quality and accessibility of the parks and green spaces. And we're trying to garner support from the public to move it to the Planning Commission as the first step, then to the City Council, and ultimately having the mayor's office sign off into this to enact it as law.
Are there any particular parks or green spaces that are in a more desperate need of revitalization?
We haven't identified anyone in particular. We're literally looking at the policies to implement new areas that deserve smaller park areas.
Uh-huh.
We do have lots of parks, obviously, City Park, Audubon Park, Armstrong Park is another city agency, but we've got a lot of small parks like Lafayette Square is very well maintained in that sense,
mm-hmm.
Washington Square, but there are a number of smaller parks around the area that really have not been attended to. Last year, we actually identified along the Sunset Boulevard statue areas there. That's also a neglected park area, but it's also an attempt to bring it to the attention. But this Big Green Easy Plan is not to focus on one particular site, but rather all the sites that are available throughout the city.
Yeah, I was just in, I've spent some time in other cities just in the last month. I've been in both Boston and Dallas and observed that, some of their parks, many, if not most of their parks, don't have fences around them. And I live very close to Armstrong Park. And for many, many years, I lived very close to Washington Square Park. And it just, I don't know. I understand there's a public safety concern there, but it just makes me sad that you can't visit those places at night. I would hope that a revitalization plan in the future would include, I don't know, maybe some sort of effort to make these spaces easier for the public to use at their discretion.
Yeah, those are a few that you mentioned that are enclosed after dusk. I will say that with Armstrong Park, for instance, many times, and I should mention, we identified Armstrong Park last year as one of the endangered nine mm-hmm. for purposes of the development for the Congo Square, the Mahalia Jackson, and the small auditorium. But when there are events there, and even when the opera is there, people are able to access the facilities through the park when they have an event.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are more events there, I suspect that would be more friendly for use in the evenings.
My guest is Tony Marino. He's the first vice president of the Louisiana Landmark Society. Tony, let's move to the neighborhood participation program. I suspect that most people who aren't active in their neighborhood associations or neighborhood advocacy groups don't know what this is. And I wonder if you could explain what the neighborhood participation program is and why it's being criticized for not effectively involving residents in land use decisions.
Well, the neighborhood participation program actually is a good concept, but it's really lost the effectiveness with regard to involving the residents in future land use decisions that affect their respective neighborhoods. What has happened is the developers almost taken a check-the-box approach. Oh, we met with the neighborhood. And sometimes part of the problem is it's not well attended. It's not enough notices. It's not videotaped in many cases. And also, the meetings are held many times away from the neighborhood itself. And basically, there's been a failure to keep the practice, accurate in terms of when there are realistic meeting times, what are the requirements, some of the issues may be. It turns out sometimes to be a bait-and-switch tactic where the final project basically says, we met with the neighborhood, there are no substantial objections, and they push the improvements forward without requiring the accurate information or presentation from the neighborhood itself as a result of those meetings.
So what's the enforcement mechanism here? Is there a department in City Hall or somebody's office that would say to developers?
Well, it's the City Planning Commission, yeah. Sure. And part of the thing, we think there should be an official note-taking. There should be video recordings that are made available, and there should be stricter follow-up mechanisms for any suggested changes or concerns that the neighborhood raised. And if they fail to comply with the those factors, then perhaps there should be penalties or other measures that would cause the transparency between the engagement between the community and the developer itself.
Yeah, certainly I would hope there's easy things you could do, like, hey, if we're going to have a meeting about Pontchartrain Park, the meeting has to be in Pontchartrain Park and at a time when most people can attend, you know, not at 2 p.m. on some idle Monday, you know, but you put it in
exactly.
the evening when
and
most meetings
are. Exactly, and it should be available. And there's no question that you could given technology today for those people who can't physically be there, perhaps a Zoom meeting for those who can
Absolutely.
At least watch it and videotape it and record it. And also the fact that once the notes are taken from the concern of the neighborhood that brought in, that to the extent possible that they try to implement those concerns in the development of the project.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Let's go ahead and move on to the Topgolf development that you mentioned earlier. This has a lot of people in the Lower Garden District raising concerns about inappropriate development. You know, it's, they say that the Topgolf development is out of scale with the other buildings. It's going to, you know, disrupt the, you know, aesthetic, you know, presentation of that neighborhood. Tell us more about how we got to this place and what lies ahead.
Well, it's actually part of the River District development. And part of the site is actually owned and operated by the Convention Center Group. And there's a question about the Topgolf facility that the original plan, and this is somewhat related to the neighborhood participation program, the original plan was they were going to have low-scale development as well as affordable housing, grocery stores, and other retail outlets in the site. And by some sort of amendment, the council passed the idea to allow Topgolf. And it's quite large. I don't know if you've driven up to Baton Rouge off of I-10, you'll see a similar operation mm-hmm. where it's a massive site of perhaps 175-foot poles and lighting that's over there constantly throughout the evening as well. So the process really lacked transparency. It was sort of, again, a city development really was a systematic failure to include the concerns of the Lower Garden District.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Tony, let's pause right here and we'll come back and do the remaining five endangered sites. This is the nine most endangered sites in Louisiana for 2024. My guest is Tony Marino from the Louisiana Landmark Society. When we come back, we'll talk about the Inner Harbor Navigational Canal locks, the slaughterhouse, Catholic churches, Aretha Castle, Haley Boulevard, and the Lindy C. Boggs Medical Center. Yeah, you're right. We'll be back in just a couple minutes. If you want to give me a call or a text, we can start getting you lined up here, 504-260-1870. Be right back. Earlier, I said it's Thursday. Of course, it is Friday, October 4th. Looking forward to a very exciting weekend. Lots of things going on all around the city. We'll talk more about that later. I got some great stories to share with you. We got a lot to cover this hour. We're going to continue our conversation with Tony Marino from the Louisiana Landmark Society. Tony, thanks for sticking around. Now, this next item that we're going to talk about is the one that I know the least about. This is mostly brand new information to me. The Inner Harbor Navigational Canal lock replacement. You have flagged this as a significant flood risk. Color this in for me, man. What are we talking about here? What's the issue?
Well, it's the area near the pumping station and the St. Claude Avenue Bridge, which is part of a development. After the hurricane of Katrina in 2005, there were some studies that were done to address the lock replacement and to extend the Mississippi River into New Orleans with the same sort of levee system and infrastructure. And that was based on the 2005 plan after Katrina. And it really is outdated on the economics. And part of it is going to include how this was first nominated was really the removal of a 1903 style sewage and water board pumping station called Station B, and it was going to remove the pumping station as well as the St. Claude Avenue Bridge, which was all part of the Inner Harbor Navigational Canal and the lock system that would be there, basically along St. Claude Avenue and Poland Avenue there. And so it was going to remove a number of historic sites such as the sewage and water board station, the bridge itself, but it also would perhaps threaten the safety of the entire East Bank, part of St. Bernard and Orleans Parish, by bringing in parts of the Mississippi well into the city's surroundings.
Wow. Okay. How long has this been on our radar for? Is this kind of a new development, or is this something that's been in the works for a minute?
Well, the plan has been around for almost 20 years. So that's part of the problem, is that we think if they're going to address any of the lock replacement, they need to start addressing what has changed in the last 18 or 19 years before they actually implement the process.
And who's actually got this? Is an Army Corps issue?
Army Corps is part of it, yes, and the City Planning Commission and other city officials
and the CPC
that have to address this. But this has been on the books, but it's based on a study that was done roughly in 2005.
Maybe we need another study, right?
I think before you start removing sites as the bridge and the station, as well as expanding the lock area almost within a mile of the city, that may have a problem. We know the experience not only from Hurricane Katrina, but also as a child, I remember Hurricane Betsy flooding the lower part of Orleans as well as St. Bernard.
All right, yeah, let's go down the river a little bit and talk about this slaughterhouse that you have as marked as a historically significant site threatened by neglect. For people who don't know what building you're talking about, let us know and tell us what the danger is.
Well, the building itself, and this is typical of what we've done historically in the past of identifying buildings or sites that have been neglected, and we basically view that building as a demolition by neglect. It's not something people pass by on a regular basis. It's 301 Elbow Street in the Lower Ninth Ward, and is actually owned by the Port of Orleans. And obviously, their authority and concern is more with navigation than anything else, but they have this property that was actually constructed in the 1800s. And it was a sanitation question. They had slaughterhouses throughout the city, and the city decided, and the state decided in particular, to have a one central location for slaughterhouses. And the butchers challenged that and went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court determined that the butchers' argument using the 14th Amendment was not successful. Mm. And it actually set the stage for Jim Crow laws. So it's the brickwork itself was the slaughterhouse and represents a pretty 19th century style building that had all the slaughterhouse housed in one area.
Whoa, that's nuts. The lawsuit that the butchers
it's called the slaughterhouse cases, and it's the Supreme Court case in the late 1800s.
And that set the stage for the Jim Crow laws because of these 14th Amendment issues.
Yes.
That is fascinating. Wow. So it's not really just about the brickwork. That's why it's historical.
Yeah, it has historical nature in terms of culture and legal effects affecting rights under the 14th Amendment as well.
A curious thing, Tony, and maybe you don't have a fast answer for this, but I like to get on Google Earth and just, look at buildings, not just from the street view, but, from like the 3D satellite view. And so when I was preparing all this yesterday, I went and typed in 301 Alibo Street in the Lower Ninth Ward, and it looks like from the map, like this building is already gone. There's just an empty lot there. I'm not sure if I'm misreading this somehow, but that can't be right. I mean, it's still standing, isn't it?
No, it can't be, because our brochure that we put out and we posted on the Louisiana Landmarks website, there is a photo that shows the building is intact, but it has been neglected.
I thought this can't possibly be right. This building can't already be gone. So I must just be looking at the wrong parcel or something. You know how like the street address might not be super representative of where the building actually is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But we can talk as we go down the list about a building that was featured and pictured in the catalogs in our determination that isn't there right now because it collapsed.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. Okay, I see. I'm looking at it again now. Clearly, there's a much larger structure behind this empty lot. My. Yeah, you can see the holes in the roof and everything. Okay, great. The slaughterhouse. Let's talk about these churches. You mentioned Catholic churches in general, not just one, but several that have closed or are likely to close or will close in the near future that are changing the city's architectural landscape. These buildings, you say in this article, are notoriously difficult to adapt. So in addition to losing the sort of community center that churches have traditionally been, in addition to being places of worship, you know, people gather there for all sorts of different things, it's not as if these can be readily turned into, you know, apartments or anything else besides a house of worship use. What challenges are we facing?
That's correct. It happens, yeah. Because of the nature of those structures, the adaptive use is limited. I've been to, there's obviously the church in the Marigny, the Peter and Paul Church is now the reception hall part of the association with the hotel there. Mm-hmm. There's also the Carmelite Monastery that was actually being converted into a residential use as well with the rest of the complex. But part of the problem here, there's actually all the churches have closed officially as of June of this year. And it was first brought to our attention when one of the nominating parties or groups nominated one particular church. And it was St. Teresa's of Avila. It was a Gothic Revival 1848 church. But we started looking at it, and we saw that there are a lot of churches that have architectural features, and the whole idea of a cultural effect it's going to have on the community, since it's a very large Catholic population, that the use of these properties may be largely obsolete and may sit idle for a number of years and may be neglected simply because they're not being used.
If I may humbly suggest to anyone listening who finds themselves in charge of redevelopment at an empty church, throw a theater in there. As a person from the theater community who knows well that we are running out of venues in this town, and that's one thing I've seen successfully done is you take an old church building and turn it into a performance space that's worthy of the effort.
Yeah, an example of that is the Marigny Opera House in the
Absolutely.
Bywater. That's another one. That's another one that could be used, but there are already so many uses for those things, so the nature of those churches, those structures themselves, kind of limit the use. Theaters, mm-hmm. restaurants, convention halls, reception halls, of the like.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned.
Like I said, there are some that have been converted into apartment use as well.
Yeah, I'm real pleased with what they did at the Hotel Peter Paul over there in the Marigny.
Yes, mm-hmm.
They did a great job with that. It's a beautiful facility, really nice hotel, and not for nothing. They make a mean brandy crusta, Tony. I don't know if you're into cocktails, but that's a tasty one. Let's talk about the Lindy's.
It's really popular. It's hard to get a drink sometimes.
It's packed in there, man. Had some really nice meals there. The Lindy C. Boggs Medical Center. Good grief. What a mess. This has been vacant since Hurricane Katrina. I think more than maybe anything else on this list, it's been talked about to death on this program and on the program leading into mine. What is happening with the Lindy C. Boggs Medical Center? Is it time to start using the stick instead of the carrot with these people? I mean, what's the delay?
Well, part of the problem, it's transferred to various owners over the last 18, 20 years since Katrina. And it obviously was Mercy Hospital, and it was renamed after Lindy C. Boggs, our former congressman and ambassador to the Vatican. But after Katrina, it's set idle. It's gone through different ownership with different plans. The current owners, I think, have very good intentions, but it's been marred with financial obstacles, regulatory problems, and also it's been an eyesore that it invites squatters and graffiti. You can see that all over the building. Mm-hmm. It's quite a large complex, and some of it may not be of any historical value, but it's the original structure is in the 1950s. The neighborhood of the city has been suffering it for a long time, and ultimately we think it's what the neighborhood would like to see is either the building either be rehabilitated, sold to somebody who can do it, and this may sound strange from a preservation group like Landmarks, but actually perhaps demolished and make way for a nicer area of green space that's close to the Lafitte Greenway as well than Bayou St. John.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I understand these things are always more complicated than meets the eye, but it just takes my breath away that the real estate value of that property's got to be astronomical. I mean, it's in the center of everything, not to mention its proximity to the Lafitte Green A, which has seen an explosion of development since it opened up a couple years ago.
Exactly, you see a lot of commercial developments and residential developments along the Greenway as well.
Yeah, it seems crazy to me that somebody couldn't have figured out a faster way to either rehabilitate the building or just knock it down and do a couple sticks on bricks and put, you know, 1,000 apartments there. That might help out.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Let's finish up with the O.C. Haley Boulevard. It's seen some really exciting revitalization over the last 20 years, but there's still a lot of blight there. Tell us about the history of the neighborhood, why it changed, how we can kind of hit the gas on bringing commerce and residents back into that part of the city.
Yeah, originally, before it was O.C. Haley Boulevard, the site was called Dryad Street for 50 years. Mm-hmm. It was a very commercial area that started from basically from Jackson Avenue towards maybe Terpsichore or the areas just before the church by the interstate. And it was a popular shopping area. And it was deserted for a long time. It was revitalized. But what has happened over these last 20 years is there's still some buildings in the corridor that had been neglected. In fact, last year, some of the buildings were nominated. We didn't highlight it then. And this year, some people identified a couple of buildings that were owned by the YMCA. That was pictured on the brochure, but also another building that coincidentally, and we didn't have a crystal ball when we saw this, but the Saturday before our press conference, the week before, that it was an art gallery that the building collapsed. And so it was one of the buildings that we included in the corridor. Certainly there's been a lot of revitalization. You've got the Cafe Reconcile. You've got the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, the Jazz Museum that's there. But there's still a number of potential buildings, both from a commercial standpoint and a residential standpoint, that have been neglected.
Okay, great. We're out of time, Tony, so we better stop there. Anything else you want our audience to know before we let you go?
Well, Ian, if they want to know more about Louisiana Landmark Society, there's a website that you can see all the details of all of these properties and issues that we've highlighted. And we always have our Fête des Jardins, the end of this month on the 27th. It's a great garden party and music and fun. So if they're interested in that, and we wonderfully support the Petone House, because that is property that we own, that we saved, over 60 years ago.
Absolutely.
And it's right on Bayou St. John at the beautiful site.
Yes, I've been. Not too long ago, I think I went and did a home tour over there, and we checked out the Pito House. Oh, great. Thank you so much, Tony Marino. Thanks for your time, your work, and your way. Nice meeting you today. Have a great weekend. Stay dry.
Thank you, Ian.
Absolutely. There he goes. Louisiana Landmark Society, folks. Check it out. They're doing good work, trying to save, these endangered sites in our neighborhoods and in our city. When we come back, I'll tell you about an exciting new offering from McDonald's. I think you're going to like this. I know I'm looking forward to it. We'll do the news bomb around 2:10. If you want to give me a call before then and talk to me about anything you just heard from Tony, maybe tell me what you think is an endangered site that should be on the list. If it's not one of the 9 endangered sites this year, maybe it could be next year. Give me a call. Some people are already texting in and saying, hey, here's some endangered sites I want to suggest. I'll read some of those when we come back. I'm Ian Hoke in for Scoot. He'll be back on Monday, and I'll be back right after this. This is news you need to know. I haven't heard anybody else talking about this, but I'm going to do it. And some people aren't going to like it, but I'm going to tell it to you just like it is. Reading now from WWL.com. The Chicken Big Mac makes its debut in the United States next week. Reading from the article, a new twist on a classic McDonald's menu item will be available starting next Thursday, replacing the 2 all-beef patties is tempura chicken patties. The special sauce, chicken, pickles, onions, lettuce, and sesame seed bun remain. With the introduction of the Chicken Big Mac, we're excited to pay homage to one of our most iconic menu items, the Big Mac, and introduce it to a whole new generation of fans, said Tariq Hassan, the chief marketing and customer experience officer at McDonald's USA. By tapping into some of our fans' biggest passions, from dupe culture. What is dupe culture? Do you know what that means?
I'll do some Googles.
D-U-P-E? Dupe culture? What the hell is dupe culture? by tapping into some of our biggest passions from dupe culture to live streaming.
Okay, I got it.
What is it?
Dupe culture is the Gen Z abbreviation for knockoff brand of expensive items.
Okay. All right. Those Zoomers in their words. Okay. All right. So it's a knockoff. The Zoomers are passionate about knockoffs?
I mean, I guess. I'm not really passionate about it. That's all I could afford, so that's why I use the knockoffs.
Man, Zoomers are weird.
My jewelry's already turning different colors.
Yeah, we see, man. There is truly something for everyone to enjoy in this campaign. We're bringing experiences that will surprise and delight them, all before the Chicken Big Mac hits restaurants. I, myself, am excited about the Chicken Big Mac. I'll mess with a Big Mac, but I think it's time for me to try something else.
So it's just a chicken sandwich with more stuff on it.
Chicken sandwiches are hot right now, Coleman. So they I mean, you can get the all sorts of different chicken sandwiches from Macker's, but this is the Chicken Big Mac. You see, it's a little different. I'll read some of your texts about endangered sites after we get caught up with the news with Chris Miller, and then we'll do the news bomb, and I'm going to talk to you about a really wild, wild story from the Donald Trump campaign. More after this. I'm Ian Hoke on WWL.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.